Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. And I cannot think of a better way to begin a week of morning shows than with our good friend, Dr. Art Sear, a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College, the director of the Clausen Center, the author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country and indeed around the world. And Professor Sear, of course, joins us once a month to offer his insightful analysis of all kinds of different current events and issues. And Professor Sear, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I always appreciate being here with you. And it's also good to acknowledge the memory of Beverly and Frank Falduto, whom you mentioned. They were both very much involved with Carthage College. And Frank is the one who introduced me to this radio program.
Oh, is that right?
A long time ago, yeah.
Well,
he sought me out.
Huh. Well, very good. Well, I'm glad he did, because I can scarcely imagine this program without these monthly conversations
well,
that we have.
Very kind. Thank
and
you
of course,
feeling.
And of course, once in a while, we also have you on when the Clausen Center has brought an important visitor to campus, someone who you think would also be of interest to our listening audience. So that's also something we're really grateful for.
Thank you.
So, of course, the biggest news, and it was news that was extraordinarily surprising, was the unexpected death over the weekend of one of the justices on the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia. And, of course, he has been a monumentally important figure on the Supreme Court. And I had forgotten until I just reread this morning that he was at this point in time the longest sitting of all of the justices on the Supreme Court, or I believe mm-hmm. I read that right.
Of the current justices.
Right.
Yes.
But beyond, of course, sheer longevity, he has been, of course, a very, very important figure. Before we talk about the process in which a successor will be named and all of the contentiousness, which is already springing up around that, I wonder if you would just share some thoughts on who Justice Scalia was and just how important he has been over the course of the last quarter century or so.
He was one of the most visible and literally vocal Supreme Court justices. He was intellectually quite talented, as virtually all Supreme Court justices are, in my view, in one way or another. He was more self-conscious than they tend to be in placing himself in the public eye. He's been described as the first of the celebrity Supreme Court justices. Until not too long ago, it was considered important for justices to be not only dignified and responsible, but also effectively aloof from the public. And to me, he very much personified our times in terms of overthrowing tradition, because he gloried in being a celebrity and engaging in partisan politics, including seminars for newly elected conservative freshman members of Congress in the House of Representatives not long ago. Hmm.
I read that he was what we call an originalist. That is one of the bedrocks, at least, of his concept of what he and the court was to do, was as much as possible to sort of align with what the original thought of the framers of the Constitution were, to not take what their attitudes were in the late 18th century and sort of transform them into what they perhaps would have been now in the 21st century, given our new challenges, but to really, at least in theory, to hold fast to what it is they were allowing as they drafted the Constitution. Is that your understanding also of who he was in terms of his central legal perspective?
Yes. I'm not an expert on the Supreme Court, I should say, with emphasis, nor a lawyer. That's what he emphasized in terms of projecting his own public image. My own thought, for what it's worth, is that the genius of the founders is reflected most of all in the fact that we have a rather brief constitution. And as products of the Enlightenment and Renaissance people, they were very conscious of the fact that the world was changing quite rapidly in their time. And I think their true genius isn't in saying that the world should stay this way and we are doing what we can to preserve our order, but the world is a rapidly changing place. From their point of view, it was rapidly changing. From ours, it seems rather staid. But especially as an aging male, I think it's important for me to keep that in my own mind, and my current job facilitates that, and it's important for us to keep that in mind. There's a tendency for everyone, but I think American doctrinal political conservatives especially, to see things as static, partly because they tend to be afraid of the future, in my view.
One thing that was quite striking was to read that Justice Scalia was confirmed by a vote of 98-0. So in other words, even though I don't think he made any secret of just how conservative he was, absolutely every senator who cast a vote in favor of his confirmation. That speaks to what a different era it was back then and how these situations were viewed. I mean, we're not likely to see anything remotely like that this time around.
I wasn't aware of that. Thank you very much. I do know that he was very good at mobilizing support beyond what's termed the conservative base. Sandra Day O'Connor was confirmed at approximately the same time, I believe, and for all the changes then and now, it's very risky to beat up on a woman politically in public. And she, in effect, got a pass. She was also a very, very gifted diplomat and still is. Therefore, when Robert Bork came along, another distinguished academic but far more argumentative, it was a much more partisan. This partisanship that had been suppressed like steam in a steam engine blew off the top, and he was done in by a very ruthless partisan debate. So we can honor the founders and respect the past, but we shouldn't idealize it. It was still a very, very partisan time.
Right.
But I'm glad to know that he was able to mobilize that kind of support.
So
in the Senate.
One of the big surprises, of course, about the, well, I shouldn't say it's a surprise, but given the nature of his death, which was completely unexpected, is the fact that now there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and of course, for a lot of people, this upcoming presidential race matters perhaps the most because of the fact that whoever the next president is, he or she will be nominating at least one new justice to the Supreme Court, one would presume. So that already was in the minds of at least some voters, that that's one of the things we're sort of casting a vote for, is we're casting a vote for the person who's going to perhaps nominate one or more new Supreme Court justices. Now suddenly that opportunity is here now.
Yeah.
And the debate is raging about whether or not that vacancy should be filled now, or for some reason it should be delayed until we have a new president. First of all, I suppose that's no surprise that a disagreement like that has erupted at this moment in time.
Yes, it's. I heard on public radio on the news earlier this morning that it's hardly unprecedented. The Supreme Court's been around as long as the Republic, and Ronald Reagan, during his last year as president, did nominate another very prominent justice, Anthony Kennedy, who was confirmed during that last year. I wish the president had not made a public speech almost immediately after Scalia's death, slapping the Republic, among other things, slapping the Republicans in the face one more time, and emphasizing that no matter what, he's going to bring forth another nominee. I think this is a good time for more subtle activity and perhaps an opportunity to emphasize bipartisanship. I certainly respect the office of the president, and I voted for President Obama, and he's the president, and I'm not. But this increasingly strong propensity of his during his second term to go out of his way to agitate the opposition. I wish things were handled differently, and this, despite that speech, provides an opportunity to do so.
Of course, to be fair, from the Republican side, we've heard some very prominent Republicans saying basically they'll vote down whoever President Obama suggests or nominates, which doesn't sound particularly conciliatory either.
No, I wasn't being partisan in this matter, sir. I assure you, I was standing above the fray. Yeah, Mitch McConnell is another one. He's actually a very effective pragmatist in terms of what gets done in the Congress, but for a long time he's been willing publicly to criticize President Obama's performance in office and his approach to the job in ways that are really unproductive and shows just how great the partisan gulf is.
So you would have nevertheless, I guess what I'm saying is President Obama's strongly worded statement was perhaps understandable, but you wish he had, in a sense, to borrow your phrase, risen above the fray.
I wouldn't say understandable, Greg. I'd say predictable. Hmm. But you do have the president, more than anyone else in our federal system, has the opportunity to take the high ground and exercise important emotional and symbolic leverage. And great presidents have done that, including Reagan.
Hmm. So do you see any political risk for the Republicans if they were to do as some have suggested and just stand in absolute opposition to anybody, even a fairly moderate justice who might be nominated? Is that a potentially dangerous course of action, or does it make sense for them to do that at this point in time?
Well, it's very tough being an actual practicing politician as opposed to a professor who talks on the radio. I do think there's an opportunity to be surprising. Our really great leaders have the capacity to do surprising things that get results politically. Reagan's surprise choice of Richard Schweiker, a moderate liberal Republican from the East Coast, when he was challenging Gerald Ford for the nomination, a sitting president for the nomination in 76, and he almost unhorsed Ford. That's the kind of example I'm thinking of. I think there's an opportunity for the president to come up, I wish, with a politician, actually. I think things function more smoothly in the past to a significant degree because we used to have politicians on the Supreme Court. What we have now is academics, activists, ideologues on both sides, and that's become the standard. Earl Warren was a very great Supreme Court Chief Justice, nominated by a very great president, Dwight Eisenhower, and Eisenhower's Supreme Court justices, Brennan, Potter Stewart, and Warren, I believe, in hindsight, they look quite good as non-ideologue, pragmatic people who respected the law and built on precedent, not what they thought we should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, of course, especially given the highly charged political atmosphere in which we find ourselves right now.
Yeah, it'll be a big issue in the campaign. You're right to bring it up right away.
Right. And let's talk about the campaign. And And it has been, of course, incredibly interesting. I loved the column you wrote that opened with a favorite line of mine from the great comic strip Pogo, and of course
that comic strip.
I remember it, but of course some of our younger listeners probably have no idea what we're talking about, but that famous line, "We have met the enemy and he is us," I think that was a very telling way to sort of open up a discussion about this really contentious presidential race. If you could wave a magic wand, what would you change this race into from what it is right now?
I'd change it into what the founders had in mind in terms, but to be direct and realistic, I think that we should have debates that are debates, fewer in number, and actual debates. What we have now is trading sound bites, very brief interchange. Hindsight's always 20/20. I think the RNC, the Republican leadership, nationally made a big mistake in turning over to the networks. Maybe they were trying to curry favor with a media that's seen as leaning Democratic, but they in effect gave the networks control over these debates. We're having far too many, and by controlling and imposing such brevity on the candidates, That's entertainment, but that's not real debate. Another reason for looking at the 60 debates between Kennedy and Nixon, it was a different culture, it was a different time. It was hardly ideal, but there were two serious men talking about the issues, not playing to the galleries. The kind of insulting behavior that Trump personifies would have been totally unacceptable then. But the fact that it was a debate reinforced the seriousness of these occasions.
Right.
And now it's just showbiz.
Right.
Of the worst sort, the crudest kind of carnival sort. Reality TV would not have been acceptable and wasn't until about a quarter of a century ago. Promoters and shills who brought this stuff forward were regularly turned down by the networks back when we had networks because they knew it would be self-defeating and get them in serious trouble with the average sane American. It shows us, the enemy is us, it shows us that this kind of behavior has now become pervasive right. on the public screen. It's absolutely outrageous and terrible. And I hope I don't sound like just one more grumpy old man. It really is terrible. It's a reflection on us. Not them, us, that this kind of thing is not only profitable but productive in terms of votes.
Well, right, because there's a whole lot of people
absolutely
that are
terrible.
Watching this. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and want to watch it.
Right, exactly. I mean, make the choice. The choice.
And, of course, since we're picking a man or a woman, excuse me for interrupting, but this is extremely, they are going to have, it's symbolism that's accurate, they are going to have a good deal of independent authority in the use of force, including potentially nuclear weapons. In this still stable world, I think we should all sit back and reflect on just how we're behaving collectively.
Hmm. Of course. I, for one, find that I can't watch the debates. I mean, and I don't see them being, I mean, not only are they incredibly unpleasant to watch, I mean, for somebody who's averse to conflict, I mean, and tension, they're the last thing you should watch, but also in terms of, you know, just plain old substance. I just don't find them worth the time to watch, which I think you found a little shocking. But I am so unhappy that they, like you said, that they aren't real debates where really substantial time is given to complicated issues and a real exchange of ideas occurs. It just doesn't happen. It's trading of insults. And sound bites.
In fairness, I think it's helping the Democrats because what we're talking about primarily is the Republican debates. I think the Democrats have been more serious. They've been discussing the issues, even when there were more candidates than the two current survivors. And I think it's going to help in the. I think it's going to help the Democrats in the final election.
A couple of things that are intriguing about this race. First of all, is the staying power of Donald Trump. And I'm pretty sure that a few months back, not just you, but just about any serious analyst really doubted that Donald Trump was going to have any staying power whatsoever mm-hmm. in this presidential race. So first of all, how shocked are you that, in fact, his candidacy remains as viable as it does? I mean, I'm not asking so much like what you think personally of Donald Trump, but analyzing his success, given the outrageousness of so much of what he has said and so on. How shocking is it to you that he is as successful as he is?
It's certainly surprising. I can't say I'm easily shocked, especially at this point in life, but it is surprising. On your program, I compared him to Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann, two early front runners in an earlier Republican race who went down very quickly. She turned out to be so much of a nut that support just didn't endure, and he had some personal problems that rightly brought him down. That obviously was an error in terms of that analogy. I've been very surprised. An important fact to keep in mind is that the Republican Party is very much the minority party in terms of the electorate today. They're down to about 25% in terms of the percentage of the population that really identifies themselves as Republican, I believe. A lot more people vote Republican, but both parties have been declining over a very long period of time. There was a Republican revival under Reagan that endured for a while, but the long-term trend is down. So we're talking about people who we're talking about a party that really is a minority party in terms of the American public. Now, mind you, the Republican campaign, high turnout so far indicate there are people voting who don't normally vote. There are people drawn to the campaign who aren't normally active in politics. That's a change. Finally, populism, pretty crude and often pretty direct. Political appeals with extreme positions, that's nothing new in American politics. And it's also important, I think, to consider that context.
We, of course, are looking ahead to South Carolina and
right.
just past New Hampshire, where the victors were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. I think neither of those were big surprises, unlike Iowa, where I think a lot of people were expecting that Donald Trump would be the victor,
yep.
And of course he wasn't, coming in second to Ted Cruz.
That's right.
Are we paying too much attention to each of these primaries and or caucuses along the way? I mean, is that part of the sort of the flaw of our current system, that we're just not kind of letting this play out, but we're viewing each and every one of these steps in the process as more monumental than they are?
Probably. Well, we have so many primaries that none are decisive. It used to be that New Hampshire really could have a huge impact on what was to come. I mentioned Eisenhower. He came in very late by calculation in 52. He was not the front runner. He was not the front runner. Robert Taft was. Eisenhower's tremendous win in New Hampshire changed the calculus when there were only about 12 primaries in the country at most, and about half of that number were really seen as consequential. Richard Nixon, coming back from political oblivion in 1968, he came in very late and had a huge victory in New Hampshire. Bill Clinton, in a much more current context, the comeback kid, I believe he lost both Iowa and New Hampshire, but was able to do so well in later primaries. When we have so many more primaries, that build up momentum. You're right, we probably pay too much attention to them, but when you're the first couple of primaries, that I think that's automatic, especially with the pervasive media
right.
today.
Right. One interesting statistic was cited on actually Morning Edition today. I don't know if you heard it as well, but in exit polls in New Hampshire, an incredibly small number of voters said, in a sense, what guided their vote was the matter of electability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really didn't care about, in that moment of voting, they didn't care about November. They cared about that moment and which person they preferred.
Yeah.
They weren't thinking about electability. But, of course, the leaders of both parties are thinking a whole lot about electability and
mm-hmm.
who can they put forward who is electable by the populace as a whole.
That's an important point. We as citizens should think about doing our duty as citizens and who's the candidate that I prefer as a voter, and not do what politicians and now endlessly numerous and highly paid campaign consultants do, constantly calculate and sometimes outsmart yourself. No, we should think about who'd be the right president, who'd be the best one, and not about who's most electable.
Right. So on the Republican side, of course, we have primarily Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush. And you mention in your most recent column the governor of Ohio, John Kasich.
Yes.
Sounds like that's somebody you actually pretty much admire on that side. And I think you're wondering if he's going to begin to do a little bit better, possibly.
Well, I'm not a Republican. I think he's been a very effective chief executive. And I think it's paid off. He's come from nowhere. People, especially major TV media people, were really dismissive of him, partly because he isn't a TV personality, whatever the substance. He's pretty bland. He, I think, has the qualities of prudence, pragmatism, and he's a very effective executive. Very few politicians are. It's one reason why presidents tend to be governors or former governors, historically and currently. I found extremely appealing. Also, I don't believe the Republicans have won the White House without taking Ohio. There may be one or two exceptions, but it's a very important swing state, and it was in the last election. And I believe it's particularly important for Republicans historically.
Let's look at the Democrats and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And, of course, it is contentious between them, but not quite as contentious as it is on the Republican side. But, I mean, they are really going after each other, I mean, more vigorously than they were in the early going. You mentioned specifically to me how struck you were by Bernie Sanders' really intense attack on the legacy of Henry Kissinger. Mm-hmm. First of all, tell us what you think primarily prompted that and what you think that sort of tells us about who Bernie Sanders is and what is important to him.
Kissinger was a significant Secretary of State and National Security assistant to the president before he became Secretary of State. Whatever you think about his views, it's interesting how many people, there's name recognition, but they don't recall in any detail exactly who this guy was.
Right.
And still is. He's still a player, as Secretary Clinton indicated. He's still there.
Right, and still alive, yeah.
I'm sure in his 90s he would like to come back. he left in early 77 when Ford was succeeded by Carter. He became a red flag to the left early on during the Vietnam War, which in fairness he and President Nixon inherited. But a very extensive escalation of the air war, especially secret bombing of Cambodia and Laos, which preceded the Nixon administration, but which they greatly intensified. At the same time, they were steadily withdrawing troops on the ground in Vietnam. That came back to haunt the Nixon administration, rightly or wrongly. Also, the record is murky, but it's fair to say publicly that the Nixon administration was actively involved in overthrowing the Allende regime in Chile, and President Allende was killed, and a military junta succeeded them. Those were explosive issues for the older left. Within the last couple of years, listening faithfully to NPR, I listened as Secretary Kissinger threw down his microphone and went storming off stage. Usually he keeps his cool when a very young, earnest, I thought rather particularly righteous interviewer on public radio, the young man, insisted on raising the subject of Chile, and Kissinger said, my understanding is we wouldn't talk about that, and the young man persisted and became rather moralistic, I believe, and Kissinger. That's one dimension. Still people feel very intensely about these matters, and not just people as old as Senator Sanders. On the other side, Kissinger and Nixon, but especially Kissinger, became a symbol of appeasement, believe it or not, to the far right in the 1970s. Ford kept Secretary Kissinger on as Secretary of State, and I believe valued, and I believe he gained from having him in that position. Don Rumsfeld was able to remove Kissinger from the job of National Security Advisor. For quite a while, he had both, showing how powerful he was during that turbulent time at home as well as abroad. But the extreme right of the Republican Party in those days thought detente with the Soviet Union and China was a big mistake. We needed a much more hardline foreign policy. Ford, who was almost unseated by Reagan, as I mentioned, he kept Kissinger in the closet, and he didn't talk about the Nixon-Kissinger legacy at all, and because he was in great political trouble himself. That gets to the final point. We suffered a major strategic defeat in Vietnam and Southeast Asia when Saigon fell in the spring of 75. Nixon and Kissinger, by opening to China especially and other moves they made, they greatly mitigated the geopolitical, which is the dimension Secretary Kissinger likes to operate in. They greatly mitigated the negative consequences of that strategic defeat by the opening to China. Mm. They also faced reality and provided links that we benefit from today. I also believe the SALT I and SALT II treaties, which were achieved with the Soviet Union, and détente with the Soviet Union, were at least as important in strengthening our international position at that time. Hmm. Soviet Union fell because communism doesn't work. The Soviet Union did not fall primarily because Ronald Reagan happened to be in office and was kicking up defense spending. It fell because from Truman through the first Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, we were remarkably consistent in pursuing a foreign policy of containment. And Nixon and Kissinger played a pivotal as well as important role in that long-term, very wise American policy, which brought victory.
So what do you make of the attack by Bernie Sanders on the legacy of Henry Kissinger?
Yeah, I think what I'm describing about the far right during that era is extremely important because the Republican Party has moved so far to the right. Sanders, I think, was reflecting the left-wing hostilities and antipathies of that time. Kissinger became a symbol of everything they hated, especially about Vietnam. Senator Sanders was quite young during the Vietnam War, and it had a profound impact on him as it did on others from that generation. That's what he was reacting to. It was kind of bizarre that he brought it up, but it led to, a healthy discussion of the past, and it educated me to the fact that Secretary Clinton is very close to Secretary Kissinger. She did a very favorable review of his latest book for the Washington Post 2 years ago, his latest book, World Order. I wasn't aware of the review until this explosion when I did some research. So he may be back if we have another President Clinton.
Interesting.
He's been trying, I can assure you. He's been trying since that time.
Wow. Who would have thought? Would have thought such a thing might be? Of course.
Well, we could do worse.
Right.
But a lot of your listeners will not agree with my point of view, I can assure you.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us in the studio today Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, who joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events. You wrote recently about an outbreak of violence in Jakarta, Indonesia.
Yes.
And in the course of that, you drew an interesting comparison to the killings in San Bernardino, California. And it was really an intriguing comparison.
I'm glad you found it worthwhile.
Right,
you.
In which the one was so much in our own headlines, and the other sort of scarcely caused a blip. When one thinks about actually the relative importance of or significance of those two events, there's in some ways no comparison. But one of the things you mentioned was your objection or your concern about President Obama's response to the shootings in San Bernardino. I wanted you to elaborate on that a little bit. You wrote at one point that you felt that by him responding as strongly and directly as he did, he was in some ways diminishing the office of chief executive. Just wonder if you would help us understand what the heart of your concern there.
San Bernardino killings were a shocking and literally bloody but local crime by people who happened to be of Islamic background, who identified themselves with ISIS and associated terrorist groups. There's no evidence yet, as far as I know, that they were directly linked to them. It was not a national matter until the president made it, playing into the hands of the media, I might say, the president made it a national matter by giving a formal speech from the Oval Office. He greatly magnified the importance of this incident. He went out to San Bernardino. I wrote in the column, I believe he diminished the office he holds. I also believe he opened the door for ISIS to take credit for this, which they promptly did. We've not had a second strike since 9/11, thank God, and we can thank the federal government, especially our police and intelligence agencies, for the fact that we haven't. The president's action also reinforced the public fear that's self-evident of terrorism, and I believe has reinforced the most extreme proposals made by Republican candidates. Much more important is the terrorist attack in Indonesia. In global terms, Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim-majority country. For many years, it was a great headache for U.S. foreign policy. A leader of the neutralist but really anti-Western camp during the Cold War, a long-time, very corrupt dictatorial President Sukarno, followed by equally corrupt dictatorial President Suharto. Sukarno played both the Soviet Union and the U.S. off against one another to his own benefit. He became increasingly close to the Soviet Union. We've been discussing the Vietnam era preoccupation of Washington and our allies during the Cold War was just how far Indonesia would go. They were buying substantial weapons from the Soviet Union. Soviet crews, not long after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Soviet crews were helping man Indonesian ships. And a principal incentive for military escalation long ago in Vietnam was fear that Indonesia would, in effect, go communist. The CIA tried to overthrow and, if necessary, kill Sukarno. That's now in the public domain. The fact that the CIA was totally frustrated, defeated. Agents had to walk through the jungle to get to the seacoast to get picked up by American ships. It was a real fiasco. That was one reason, I believe, why the CIA was relatively accurate in its evaluation of exactly how things really were going during the long Vietnam War. The British had greater success. Unconventional British forces were able to frustrate Indonesian efforts to attack Malaysia, I believe. All of that is very important context for the fact that it was an unstable as well as corrupt environment during the Cold War. ISIS would love, and before them Al-Qaeda would love, to develop major support in Indonesia. They have none. These killings, which were more directly linked to ISIS, and earlier, very large, far more people were killed at a resort in Indonesia by Al-Qaeda operatives. They have resulted in no generation of wider public support for these terrorist groups. Much like Turkey, an important Islamic country that is on our side, whatever the our problems with the current president of Turkey. Indonesia is not only a huge Islamic population, they are an important source of natural resources, including petroleum. They straddle traditional massive east-west trade routes. We have a very strong anti-terrorist ally in Indonesia, and the Vietnam history is almost completely forgotten today, as far as I can tell, which is why it's important for us to remember it, especially given your reference to Kissinger, but also it's an extremely pivotal strategic asset in our current international conflict. And I hope that's clear. It's really important. I try not to talk at extreme length on your program. I appreciate your patience, but this case is really important because it's not much in the news. San Bernardino,
I was just going to say.
San Bernardino, not just because of the president's action, but San Bernardino got huge news. Indonesia should have gotten more analytic attention.
Right. And if nothing else, we should appreciate sort of the steadfast resolve of the Indonesian people.
Yeah.
That they are remaining as they are, staunchly anti-terrorist,
yes,
collectively at least.
And by the standards of the past especially, they've got a democracy that's working reasonably well. They actually do have elections. They do have alternation in power. There, as elsewhere around the globe, women are becoming far more active and prominent in politics, including leadership.
We don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but you wrote recently about the nation of Pakistan, also racked by some violence, but you caution us not to spend so much time focusing on those kind of headlines that we neglect to appreciate the relative stability which has also come over Pakistan with the orderly transition of power that occurred in 2013. You tell us the first time in the history of Pakistan that ever happened.
Yeah, thanks to elections that worked, that were internationally monitored. I don't want to sound like too much of a Pollyanna. There are real problems with Pakistan intelligence in terms of not only corruption but elements that are sympathetic to Islamic fundamentalism. They do have nuclear weapons. For that reason, we have a well-established program of very intimate collaboration by design between the American military and the Pakistani military. I dare say we cooperate in terms of the details of their weapons far more closely than we do with Israel, for instance, in terms of nuclear weapons per se. Afghanistan, there are retired military, more than one, who write about having lost the war in Afghanistan, write and publish about Afghanistan going down the drain. I don't believe the Taliban controls any province in Afghanistan. They might well eventually come back to power, but it will be very difficult. And compared to previous wars in which we've been involved, the actual evidence of control there is lacking. They can cause great difficulty. They're very good at hit-and-run actions. Much more worrisome is Iraq, and where I think the stakes are for us much higher. And thanks to the G.W. Bush administration, we are in an environment of total chaos and violence.
We should spend at least a couple of minutes talking about the cessation of hostilities agreed to by the world powers involved in the just ceaseless conflict in Syria. First of all, tell us what you can about the events that prompted that agreement. Was that agreement at all a surprise? And what hopes do you have about that being the first step in something more positive for the people of this beleaguered nation?
Well, for me, it was a surprise. I think we should see it as a pleasant surprise and a very positive development. Since the end of the Cold War, there's been an opportunity to draw Russia and China and other countries into broader collaborative arrangements, including the economic institutions of the UN. And there's also been an opportunity to collaborate in military terms in very specific situations. I think Secretary Kerry has demonstrated almost unbelievable energy and dedication to the job. I think he's a very great Secretary of State, right up with James Baker and Dean Acheson and maybe one or two others. It's very uncertain whether this agreement, which was just reached over the weekend, I believe, will hold for the long term. The Soviet Union, from about 1970, was able to establish Syria as a client state, and the current close collaboration between Moscow and Damascus builds on that traditional history. It's important for listeners to keep in mind that if Assad goes down, and I think actually it looks more like the regime will survive for the foreseeable future with Russian support, the alternative is not going to be Jeffersonian democracy. The alternative is not going to be what American officials have described in the past, especially concerning the chaos in Libya. It's not going to be a positive development. It will be a situation more like Libya. I think if we can work together with Russia in stabilizing the situation and European nations and the participants in stabilizing the situation, that's all to the good. So I think it's heartening. We'll see if it lasts. But since the end of the Cold War, I believe there are more examples of this positive collaboration among major powers, including the Iran nuclear agreement, which looks like it will hold. Just about every Republican presidential contender has announced that he will immediately abdicate the agreement. That will be hard to do in practice.
Well, that's one more reason why this next presidential election matters so very, very much.
Well, I'm glad we can close on a fairly positive note. You really cover the waterfront. I hope we've had a productive discussion for those listening.
I think so. I think very much so. And we look forward to your return to us at some point during the month of March. And anyway, on this President's Day, I'm so glad that we could have this conversation about some really weighty matters confronting not only our country, but the world. So, Dr. Art Sear, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. President's Day, it's good to mention, and I get to come back. Thank you for that.
Very good. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be talking music, first of all, with Jane Livingston, who is a professor of music at Carthage College. And she is actually retiring at the end of this year, and so her upcoming faculty recital is especially significant. She's devoting it to all kinds of beautiful scores for piano written for various major motion pictures in the 1940s. And so it will be a walk down memory lane in many, many respects. And that will be on Friday night, and we'll talk with her tomorrow in part one. In part two, actually a Carthage graduate by the name of Nick Berutian, who has resettled in the area and has created a wonderful new music group called the Bell Ensemble. And their concert coming up this weekend, Saturday night, I believe, is called Northern Lights and is devoted to music of some of the greatest Scandinavian composers. On Wednesday, you'll hear my conversation with Jane Bryant Quinn, who, of course, is one of the country's most respected authorities when it comes to personal financial planning. And she has written a book I found really, really fascinating and timely called How to Make Your Money Last, An Indispensable Guide to Retirement. You'll hear my conversation with her on Wednesday. Also, you hear the conversation that I recorded with an attorney whose new book is called Divorce Demystified, in which he explains some of the important tenets that are involved in divorce. On Thursday, a colleague of Professor Sears is going to be joining me, Professor Yuri Maltsev. We'll be talking about his recent trip to South Africa. And we'll probably find the time to talk about a few other topics with Professor Maltsev as well. And on Friday, we're going to be sort of building on some of the extensive public service announcements that have been made this week on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, starting today, about the very important issue of adult literacy. So we hope to be talking with representatives of both the Racine and Kenosha Literacy Councils on Friday's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. You'll find the archive right on the front page. Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Now the WGTD weather forecast from the National Weather Service for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Today is going to be a cloudy day, seasonal temperatures, a few scattered flurries, a high today of 29 degrees. Under cloudy skies, our overnight low will be 22 degrees. Cloudy and seasonal again tomorrow, though we'll warm up to 36 degrees. Wednesday, cloudy and a high of 29. Thursday, cloudy skies, a high of 37 degrees. We see a sharp rise in temperatures as we get to Friday, a high of 53 degrees with